I'd like to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education. This is one of the best parts of my job, as many of you know, and I'm glad you're here to share it with me. Sorry to say, we are in the final days of Tuesday evenings for spring 2012, but we're going to go out big next week with none other than Lucy Lepard. I'm kind of imagine you know who she is, but if you don't, I suggest you Google her. Then I suggest you get a friend that you really care about, invite them to join you, and get here early so you can get a ticket. I'm very excited about having Lucy Lepard here next week for Tuesday evenings. Tonight is another special opportunity. We are so fortunate to have the most sincere and talented Mr. Gary Ruff with us. He's here to share his story, at least in part. And this week it's with pictures throughout. Gary is an artist in my mind. His work is brimming as it connects with life. Gary draws on things found, observed, and read. His processes are long and thoughtful with results that are generous, perplexing, engaging, tender, sometimes seeming meager, often personal, and always compelling. Born in Glasgow, Gary received his BA in 1995 and his MFA in 1998 from Glasgow School of Art. Forming life relationships and developing alongside many of contemporary art's biggest names, such as Douglas Gordon, Christine Borland, Jenny Saville, and others of the Glasgow School of Art fame. Gary also attended, I'm going to butcher this, how do you say it? See, now he says it in that Scottish accent, and I still can't understand it. The Horschel Day Kunst in Berlin. It's quite an honor, and he was there in 1997. Shortly after graduating, after graduate school, he moved to New York, where he now lives and works. Included in important group exhibitions at the Leysen Gallery in London and Green Naftali in New York as early as 1995, still in school. Gary has shown regularly across Europe and the States in cities including Paris, Edinburgh, Glasgow, London, Copenhagen, and New York. In 2003, he was included in Scotland's pavilion at the Venice Biennale with a project Xenomap. Solo exhibitions have included Who is Everything at PS1 in New York in 2004, Take Me With You at Sorsha Dallas in Glasgow in 2006, and Rabo Karabekian. I've only read that. It's, of course, the character from Kurt Vonnegut's Bluebeard. But Rabo Karabekian / Gary Ruff at McCaffrey Fine Art in 2007. And Nothing is Enough at Yvonne Lambert Gallery in Paris in 2008. And that is just to name a few. Most recently, his solo exhibition, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, etc., received a great deal of attention as Gary developed a show during a 5-week residency at the Glasgow Gallery, Sorsha Dallas, last September, shortly before opening Bad Luck Dice at number 35 Gallery in New York in November, and having work featured in Industrial Aesthetics, Environmental Influence on Recent Art from Scotland at Hunter College during those same months, which explains to me why Gary was insistent that he get one of the later dates for Tuesday evening. He needed time to recover from 2011. I'm really glad that he had the foresight to know that he would have it together in time to do this lecture, because I have a feeling I was asking him as he was in the midst of preparing for all of those exhibitions. But he did, and it is why you're here tonight. So without further delay, please join me in welcoming Gary Ruff.
Hi. Repetition, the act of repeating, repeated action, performance, production, presentation, repeated utterance, reiteration, something made by or resulting from repeating, a reproduction, copy or replica. So should I repeat that? I had the idea when when Terry had asked me to do the talk, that I could just read to you the definition of repetition for 45 minutes. But the whole thing about the work and the whole thing about giving this talk is to make connections. And I think you'll see that in the work, it's really, that's what it's all about. And now that I told you about the idea, I don't actually need to do it. So tonight, I want to talk about those connections, and that might get repetitive. So in preparing for this, I've been going through a lot of my work from the past, and the distant past, and the not-so-distant past. And it's going to be a little bit schizophrenic chronologically, so we'll see. And I'm looking for these connections constantly in life and constantly through the work. And so going through these works, I've been looking for the ones that I thought were there, and I've discovered a few that I didn't realise were there. So, of course, that would lead to the repetition of things already written, already said. But not really, because that doesn't really become a repetition. Not really. So I'm going to try and expose myself. I'm going to try and make a connection with you through the work, and maybe that's just all the work needs to be about. So how would we describe the obsessive compulsion to repeat oneself? As an obsession, as a compulsion? How would we describe the compulsion to make art? A desperate obsession to try and connect, perhaps? Does the production of the art calm the compulsion or feed the obsession? So in my work, there's a constant process that's pretty repetitive. Make, remake, redo, rethink, reassess, then edit, which is always the hardest bit. So let's start with a work that absolutely fights the notion of editing. If we can, maybe we can go down on the lights a bit. So this work was featured in the show that Terry mentioned called Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, etc. in Glasgow at the beginning of September last year. So A Premonition of a Future is an ongoing work. Basically what the work is these are copies of the George Orwell novel 1984, and I'm trying to collect 1,984 copies of 1984. So, you know, yet again, pushing that rock up the hill. And although initially it might seem like a kind of trite idea, you know, we get it, it's a one-liner, it goes a little bit beyond that, because I don't know how familiar you all may be with this novel, but in it, Orwell describes a lot of what's actually come to pass in our society, politically and culturally. And he was writing this in 1948. You know, so we all know the phrases. Like, even if you've not read the book, you know that there's a TV show called Big Brother. You know that we're under constant surveillance. We don't quite yet have the telly screen in our apartments watching our every move, telling us what to do, when to exercise. And at the very beginning of the book, the protagonist, Winston Smith, his first action is to buy a diary. So he has a journal, and he's starting to write in his journal every day, this process. But that's a crime. It's a thought crime. So that's another talk for another time. Basically, my interest is in Winston Smith. His job is he works for the Ministry of Truth, and he goes back into the old newspaper clippings, the old news reports, and reassesses them and edits them and recreates them to fall in line with what the party and the government at that, and the novel is just called The Party, what the party, what their manifesto, their ever-changing manifesto may be at that particular time. People who were heroes are now criminals. People who were criminals never existed. The countries we were at war with were no longer at war. They're now our allies. So there's a lot going on in that book that really has materialised. And again, although we don't have the telly screen in our apartment watching us, we actually are under constant surveillance. We have cameras on all the roads. We have cameras in our city centres. And we're watched online, especially for our consumer habits. So my idea was, Winston's going in and he's redoing these things, and he's changing the truth, or what the truth was, but then the truth becomes this new truth. And I thought, if I could at least just garner 1,984 copies of this, I could look after these. So this novel could never be changed. So at least the novel can continue to resonate. So again, on a more conceptual level, I'm dealing with this collection. And actually, the other aspect of this is I don't allow myself to buy brand new copies. So in the book, Winston then becomes almost the fifth columnist. And the fifth columnists are called the Brotherhood. What better connection can you have than a Brotherhood of Man? And the Brotherhood have one manifesto, one copy of their manifesto, the Manifesto of Rebellion. And it has to be passed to you. In the novel, I believe Winston's at a rally for the party, watching maybe even an execution, and someone who knows that he wants to become part of this underground movement passes him surreptitiously the book, and it's called The Book. So again, my idea was it has to pass through another person's hands. Now, you could go out and buy me a brand new copy, and if you want to be part of it, please do, and send it to me. Otherwise, I have to buy second-hand copies. They have to be found in some way. But at least they have to have tactily been through someone else's hands. Other than, you know, just ordering a whole box online. It's got to be that connection. I actually have a copy from that was printed in the 1960s in the old GDR in the old East Germany. And again, that's maybe another talk for another time. So much has come out of that book, and I'm talking about truth all the time in that book. So again, I guess I have to just deal with superstition. I do a lot of work with the number 13, and these are works called Taking Giving. And actually what I started doing was tearing the number 13 from the edge of newspapers and just collecting them. And I just thought, you know, here in the West, the number 13 is traditionally a bad luck number. So I figured if I could just tear, again, collecting, if I could just collect all these number 13s as much as I could, maybe I could just keep that bad luck. Then protecting others from having bad luck. Therefore, it's taking, I'll take that, and giving, I'll give you a chance to live without this bad luck. What I did to myself, of course, was something quite different. I spent 7 years collecting number 13s, and then, as you can see, they're quite meticulous, and there's 13 in this series. If you look at the amount of 13s there, it's actually almost an instant headache for me, but they become quite beautiful, and I just really want to talk about what I'm doing. You know, we could talk about relations to other collage artists like Kurt Schwitters or whatever, but I don't think we need to talk about that tonight. So again, you see this process, this series, this taking, reassembling, redoing, editing, and that's a kind of constant for me. And the whole thing about this, what I wanted to mention was it was 7 years of collecting number 13, so 7 being this lucky number here in the West again, 13 being the unlucky number. Remember that number 13 and that number 7. So I guess I'm just taking the bad luck away, but at the same time, am I really just Winston Smith again at his desk, going through these things, taking it, reassessing it, changing it? Am I trying to purify this bad luck? I mean, I don't know. It would seem like a futile kind of exercise to me, but exercise is important. You have to keep working. You have to work. It just has to, you know, sitting at my desk in the studio all those hours, like these little scraps of paper, the cheap glue, the tweezers, just that goes there. No, that goes, this goes here, right. Okay, so just driving myself crazy. Feeling like this was a really bad trick that I'd played on myself, but unable to walk away from it until it was completed. So yeah, years of papers, years of magazines, second-hand books, just looking for this number 13. So as you see, you know, I do a lot of work with the number 13. So traditionally here in the West, the number 13 is unlucky and the number 7 is lucky. And I was trying to research this for the talk. And the idea, you know, I have some stuff here, why 7 is lucky. The Pythagoreans relate it to being the perfect number of the addition of 3 and 4. Which is the triangle and the cube, which are regarded as being the perfect forms. There's anciently, there was the 7 ancient planets, the sun being the greatest planet, the sun, the moon, and the moon changes every 7 day. And then, of course, there's the biblical relation to God making the earth in 7 days. But at the same time, with the biblical thing, I don't really buy that because there's 7 deadly sins, so I'm not quite sure. And in the 13, well, the 13, I know a bit more about this, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but it's considered to be unlucky. You know, traditionally, I guess it was number 13 was, there was 13 people at the Last Supper, again, a biblical reference. But I think what predates that is in Norse mythology, there was also a reference to a dinner where Loki, the god of mischief, turned up as an unwanted guest and wreaks havoc, and he was the uninvited 13th guest. And then Friday the 13th, is regarded as a spectacularly unlucky day. And there's one just around the corner. And that's to do with the papal persecution of the Knights Templar, supposedly, historically. But there's a Friday the 13th later this week, and later this year on July the 13th, it's also a Friday the 13th, it'll be my birthday. The 13th day of the 7th month. So, I kid you not. So this is a neon self-portrait. It's the number 13 in blacklight neon 7 times. And I had the glass bent backwards, so it's like a reflection in a mirror. So the light actually comes from behind. So it's bent backwards, it's blacklight, so it's almost like anti-light. And the glow comes from behind. The light actually comes from behind. I think this was a studio shot. So that's the neon self-portrait. You know, maybe it's just tricky. Maybe it's just, you know, it looks better that way. It's pretty. And it's 7 different typefaces. And this next work, I'll talk about neon some other time, right? So this next work was something else that's kind of important to me. Again, if we just backstep a little bit back to literature. Kurt Vonnegut, I don't know how familiar you all may be with his work, but he wrote a novel called Bluebeard in the 1980s, I believe it was. And his main character in Bluebeard is the painter Rabo Karabekian, who is an abstract expressionist who becomes sensationally famous, but his paintings collapse. He uses this super hot, fantastic new product called Satin Duralux, which is actually a house paint, and he becomes very famous, very popular. The paintings are selling for millions and millions of dollars, and then they just, because he hasn't sized and treated the canvas properly, the paint peels away from the canvas and just leaves these blank canvases, which of course entirely appeals to me. And Vonnegut, I think, is like an incredible humanist writer and, you know, a fantastic character. I'm a bit of a fan. This is a lesser known novel of his, and it wasn't particularly well received, but I think it's fantastic. And a lot of his critique is about the abstract expressionists in this. But this character, Rabo Karabekian, is fantastic. I truly think you should go and buy this book. So anyway, I wrote to Mr. Vonnegut. I had moved to New York in 1998, and I actually was kind of stunned coming from Glasgow, which I don't want to be down on where I'm from, but I thought I was moving from Glasgow to New York, bright lights, big city. And I was kind of surprised by this hang-up that I think a lot of the art community, or the, certainly the guys that I was kind of befriending at that time, the hang-up they still had about painting, and about very masculine painting. You know, we're all down the Cedar Tavern knocking them back with Barnett Newman. Well, we're not. But so I wrote to Kurt Vonnegut and said, could I remake these paintings that you describe in the book? He only describes two in the book. So I wrote to Mr. Vonnegut. I tracked down his address. I hope you... Yeah, I guess I whited it out. That's good. I shouldn't be exposing people's addresses. And I wrote to him and asked him, you know, and of course there's a total degree of hero worship in this. So I wrote to him, I explained who I was, what my background was, what I felt about painting and how it related to what I thought he was saying about painting, and of course being new to New York. And, you know, obviously just try to meet my hero. So he writes back, sends me this fantastic letter. So we start this correspondence about the project. I get his okay to make these paintings. It was, you know, it was amazing. It was like David Bowie phoning you up and saying, yeah, okay, let's... I don't know what you'd do with David Bowie if he phoned you up. So we continue this correspondence. My letters are getting shorter. He just can't even be bothered by this point writing me a letter back. He's sending me postcards. But this is so Vonnegut, I think, anyway. We might talk on the phone. So I had a phone relationship with Kurt Vonnegut, which is still kind of hard for me to believe. It's really happy, like, just remembering this. We move on. And this is so great. It's just... Funny Guts is his nickname, apparently. Old Funny Guts. So we kept in touch. Oh, there's my address. Yeah. Let's get that off the screen. Now, if you phone me up, I don't know what I'm going to do. But so here's some of the paintings. And I had approached... there was a gallery who were interested... and showing these paintings, and it was perfect because they were on the Upper East Side of New York, and obviously in the art scene in New York now, everything's in Chelsea, and everything, you know, you can trot out a Barbara Gladstone and go over to Comme des Garçons and buy yourself some $300 socks. And but this gallery was on the Upper East Side in the East 70s, which is where you would have seen those kind of paintings in the 1950s. So that worked well, that worked in my favour. Here's my Zip paintings. Rest in peace, Barnett Newman. And somebody came to this, a friend of mine who is a very established painter, and said to me, wow, I'd never realised you can paint, but I still don't believe I can, so... So unfortunately, the little addendum to this story is Kurt and I were talking on the phone a lot, and the last time I spoke to him, I'd just come back from being back home, and I spoke to him on the telephone. I was like, hey, I'm back, I just got back from Scotland, and you know, we really should meet. I brought you back an incredible bottle of whiskey. I'm not going to call it Scotch, it's called whiskey. So... he was a bit of a whiskey drinker, old Funny Guts. And he was like, yeah, great, we'll get together. We'll get together next week and we'll drink this bottle of whiskey together. And the last thing he said to me was like, okay, go get some sleep, which I thought was a very strange thing to say. And then a few days later, I read in the paper that he'd actually had a bit of a fall in his home. He was getting on. So he'd had a bit of a fall in his home and he'd never really quite recovered, and unfortunately passed away before we met in person. But when we did the show, his widow, Jill Crements, who, if you're not aware of her, she was the first female staff photographer for Life magazine. She met Vonnegut shooting a portrait of him. She told me a great story. It should be for another time, but I'm going to tell you this one. So she told me that when she was this young thing from New Jersey working in the sort of traditional press kind of environment in New York, all the guys had like their press card in their car, and you'd get the call like a celebrity was spotted or there's been a homicide, and they would be speeding away in their car, got the news. She would be listening to them on a pirate radio, waiting for the calls, listening to the cops. She'd jump on her moped and go the wrong way up one-way streets and get there before them and make the shot. So that's how she made a name for herself. She came to the opening, and she was amazing. She made an incredible speech, which was totally impromptu. And that was very nice. So that's that story. And here's the paintings. So yeah, I'm going to backtrack a little bit again. As I said, it was going to be chronologically schizophrenic tonight. Doesn't mean you can't have a good time. But so I'm going to backtrack to those newspapers with those little corners torn out of them. And I remember one of the first works I made when I made to New York, and of course I had a very, it was frugal times, shall we say. So I was making work with whatever I could. I didn't have any means at all at my disposal, but I still have to keep making the work. I don't know what will happen when I do stop, but, you know, it should be quite a day. And I was looking through these free newspapers. Great, perfect free material, like the New York Press and the Village Voice. And I was cutting up some stuff, making collage from these newspapers, and we'll get to something else in a minute. And I started looking at the classifieds purely from curiosity. And these classifieds, some are just, you know, a guy looking for a date or a girl looking for a date, and some are a wee bit more liberated, shall we say. I mean, it is a Village Voice. So you would write your little paragraph, it seems, and you would choose your own headline. So I was just cutting out whatever headline caught my eye. So it was kind of Dadaist, you know. And these people are looking for something, try to catch somebody's eye, catching mine. And again, it's this go back, look through things, redo it, edit, back again, cut it up, do it, let's go. So we'll just flick through a few of these. And these are called found poems, because they're just, to me, they were just like this one-line poem that they're fantastic. And of course, you can tell in some of them, there's a couple here that you're like, well, that'll be up to your imagination. I think I must have put my thumbprint on that one. So intentionally, this was not me, mine. I nearly gave the game away. Yeah. But again, these are just people looking for a connection, right? That's what it's all about. Uh-huh. Oh. But isn't that amazing how many of them reference art as well, though? I mean, that really struck me. It's... I don't know how you got that. Neither. So this just finding things and taking them and reappropriating them and somehow making them my own, but I don't really want that to sound like then I'm really claiming any kind of ownership over anything. But, you know, you see what you see and you do what you can do with it, basically. Relates to this next piece that I'm going to show you, which I actually showed here in Fort Worth about 4 years ago. around the same time as the general election. The last, you guys don't call it the general election here, you just call it the election, right? I guess that's a more British term. So, again, going through newspapers, again, something very tactile, very, let's get my hands dirty, you know, get that ink under your fingernails and stuff. And I guess I was just looking for the word us. I'd been asked to be in this exhibition down here in Fort Worth at the TCU Contemporary Gallery. And it was about the time of the election, and I thought, well, do I really need or want to make something political? And what's more political than being with another human being? That's what politics should be all about, I think, like us looking after each other, some kind of nurturing, perhaps. And so, of course, it says the US. So it was a play on that. It's the US general election. And I still wanted to make this more like personal politics, or what matters to me. Not that I'm treating politics in this country lightly at all. But these were installed like this. Just all these us's, you know. And what's more personal than saying to somebody, us? That's it. It just pretty much just says it all. If you look at someone, and I'm here and you're there, and I just say, us. Kind of says it all, really. I'd moved beyond the cheap glue at this point, and I was using cheap sellotape, or whiskey tape, as you call it. Okay. So, the reason I was using that was, you know, just as like the newspaper would kind of get that beautiful patina as it ages, it becomes yellow and stuff. Hopefully this cheap sellotape will deteriorate at a similar level. Then there would be no us. So again, it's like the tactility of that relationship and how we move on. You need to look after these things, otherwise they do just disintegrate. So I took it a little further. I started making these pieces poison pen letters. You know, you see these in movies and stuff, usually, you know, like $1 million by midnight and don't try anything funny or the girl gets it or whatever. And nobody asked the girl. So, and I just thought, what if you took something like that that's anonymous, the whole idea is anonymity and malevolence, but you turned it on its head and made it something like romantic. It's still anonymous, but romantic and kind of pleading. Like, what kind of ransom are you looking for then? You know, what kind of settlement do you want? Like, maybe a connection. So this is a series of these. They're called Poison Pen Letters, this series of works. And, you know, it's just that psychological twist using this technique. And again, this would be a practice going on in a studio where maybe I was working on a video work or something else. Keep going. The way I find that I like to work, or the way I find I work best, is like, I think I spoke to some of the students yesterday, and I think I mentioned a couple of times that if you came into my studio and saw where I work, it looks like three people are working in there. So again, as you see, the work jumps about the place. I actually physically jump from one desk to the other. And I just think each one feeds the other and kind of calms the other down and pushes things along and kind of keeps me a bit more level-headed, or as level-headed as I can get. So we'll look at some of these. This one's really pretty manic. And I get, you know, and each one has their own kind of mood, their own kind of temperament. You know, some, like the last ones, are quite calm and beautiful and almost like a Valentine almost. This is kind of crazy and, you know, pleading and desperate, it looks like to me. And I'm going to, you know, I mean, a lot of my work is, everything I do is, it comes from me. So I'm just going to let you draw your own conclusions to some of these. This one has a little story behind it. So looking through these newspapers every day, the process, the cutting up, get it, grab it, where's my tweezers, okay? I was going through the newspapers and I'm like, oh, I see this sentence, who do you love? Perfect, looks exactly like something I would do. As you've seen from the previous ones, I'm like, great, I'll just, it's like a ready-made, you know? And a lot of the work, especially with this, and if we go back to the found poems, like these little sentences, if you strip away that context of what the actual, where it came from and what their real message was, what that person was looking for, everything's open-ended. And like I said a second ago, just make your own conclusions as to what you're reading there. But you'll make your own conclusion, because what kind of day did you have today? You know, did you have a fight with your boyfriend this morning? Did you make love last night? Did you have a good day at work? Was your boss a jerk? It just depends, but you've got to come and you've got to be part of this work, and you've got to not quite complete it, because I don't like the idea of completion. It must be why I work in all these series all the time. But going through the process, that's great, that looks kind of a wee bit like a Gary Ruff there. I'll get to that in a second. But there's newspapers everywhere, so I'm looking through all these other newspapers and I see that, and I'm like, I've already been through this newspaper. And it was the same sentence in two newspapers in the same day, entirely unrelated stories. And I just thought, this, I don't know if I may be so conceited, but I was like, that is a Gary Ruff. So yeah, just removing that and coming up with a phrase, and it's such a necessity for the viewer to bring themselves, for me, hopefully they bring themselves and they read it and they think about it and they take it away, and it has its meaning. So it could be 10 different meanings to 10 different peoples, like 1,000 different meanings to those 10 different peoples, I said a minute ago, on 10 different days. So a lot of these phrases came from things that I'd overheard, things or something that just pops into my mind, and a lot of them come from song lyrics that never really meant anything at one point, and then they pop up and I'll be listening to, you know, the iPod on the subway, just like, oh wow, that again, this is how it happens to me. I'm like, why does, I never realised that line was so incredible before in this song that I've listened to 1,000 times. So it's just like the viewer coming and completing it. Whatever mood you're in, whatever, how you're grabbing these things, how you're interpreting them, how you're feeling them that day, that's how it happens to me. That's how the work gets actually made. And this is, as I'm sure some of you will know, is from a David Bowie song. That's twice David Bowie's crept in here tonight. So again, it's another series of works. These are called failed patterns, and these came about just through my regular, rigorous studio practice of drawing constantly. And I'd had this idea, you know, I wanted, in amongst it, I have this idea that I'm going to make like a Harlequin pattern drawing. So I'm drawing this thing over and over, and I can't get it right. I try a few times, like, not that many, but because it didn't take me very long to realise I can't do this. So I try a few times, and then I realise, I'm like, this is, I can't do it. And I'm looking at them, I'm like, oh, they look so much better when there's a mistake. And as you probably gathered by now, flaws, human flaws, all these kind of things are kind of important to me. And, you know, I think, like, there's a real beauty in kind of almost exposing your flaws, or at least recognizing them. Exposing them's not really always that much fun. So these are a series of works. We can't really see on these ones, but if these are, I think, they're like 24 by 20 inches. It's a lot of work. It's like going out and trying to collect 7 years' worth of number 13s. And if you look at these very closely, you can really see they're done by hand. Very meticulous, very manic. I think I did mention at the beginning obsessive compulsive tendencies. And I just think, yeah, it's interesting. So I look at these and I'm like, they're more charming with a mistake. Okay, I'll just start making them with a mistake. It's harder to do it with a mistake. Because then, and yet another cruel joke played on myself, by myself, I'm sitting waiting to make the mistake. So you're anticipating when you can make that mistake, where you'll make that mistake, how you'll make that mistake. So again, it looks, you know, obviously there's op art kind of references or whatever you may draw it, but this is just some guy in his studio driving himself crazy. And some work and some don't. Like everything, going back, some of the little found poems, some got cut out, some of the headlines did and some didn't, so... So it's just really an act in like psychological self-deception. And yeah, it's a lot tougher to make yourself make a deliberate mistake. And again, I would just go through this process. This is just a selection of a huge ongoing series. Different colours, different styles, just different ways of approaching it. Kind of reminds you of somebody's brain fragmenting, I guess. And just like the process of going through the work, the actual on the drawing, it's there as well. Like this, I'm already deconstructing the actual drawing, or the act of drawing, the act of making the drawing. Looks like it was from a second-hand book that probably had a really nice 13 in it. That too. And at the same time, I was making this... So you see pencil on black paper, on second-hand pages, deconstructed, manic, reconstructed, just going through all of these. And not really knowing what... Again, not really knowing what day related to what drawing and what act related to what was produced. But at the same time, I was making this series of drawings, which were love hearts. And this was what I'm talking about the antidote almost to what you're doing. So I'm sitting with these meticulous drawings, making these. And then on the other desk, I'm pouring nail varnish onto sheets of paper all day. When I'm not over at the other place. And I just took the symbol of the love heart as something that's like so, you know, it's so enduring. We all recognise what a love heart is and kind of what it means. And it's so enduring that it's maybe just a wee bit tired. So I used nail polish. I thought, you know, it was a kind of sensual, sexy, liquid... way of drawing. And I would pour the nail varnish onto the paper, and then I would start playing with the paper, moving it around, and seeing what would happen. So again and again, just different colours, different paper, red on red, black on white, red on white. And this is just a little selection of those as well. But that this illustrates the point that these were absolutely being created in tandem. So some, again, it looks like, to me anyway, it looks like two different bodies of work, but potentially could have been done by two very different people. And the great thing about this and this about this material and is it, there's an element of chance to it. You don't really know how it's going to behave, but and also you don't really know how you're going to behave, how much you pour on, how much you don't, where you move it, which way you move it. So I would make, of course, about 50 of these and then go in to this process that I'd created and choose maybe two or three or four that looked interesting, that made the cut. Again, it's this continual process, this continual working through. And you, the whole thing about these is you could never make them again if you tried. You just they're one-time things, and that's it. They could never be remade. I could never do that again. So, for me, these drawings were becoming quite painterly, so to speak. And I guess around that, you know, you get these really great things because some of them, a lot of them become quite sensual, you know, quite, I mean, that looks to me like it could be someone bending over, you know, so you have these kind of, maybe that's just my reference, I don't know. And some of them become almost anatomical. You just, again, you don't know how you, what you're really going to get because you're not sure where it's going to behave. And it's that idea of like when you leave something alone or what it does for you, you know. So, and to go back to the Vonnegut book, he quotes another famous fictional painter called Terry Kitchen, who is, again, a made-up abstract expressionist by Vonnegut, who has this, but nonetheless has a fantastic quote where he says when he's making a painting, he puts the first brush stroke onto the canvas, and after that, it's up to the painting to do 50% of the work. Yeah, that's quite a nice quote. And this just looks like blood. It's the way it reacts on the black paper. It's so these are a couple of pieces that I had made. These are called bad luck dice. And these were made in the studio with just scraps of wood that I'd found. I'd walk to the studio in the morning, what am I going to be doing today, you know, and I don't know actually where I got this thing about the dice, but I do have a collection of dice that live in the studio as well. In this corner, there's about 1,000 dice of different shapes and sizes, and they just kind of are just sitting there waiting to do something. I don't know what they're wanting from me, but anyway. So I made these, and I just thought, there's so much in the dice, and there's references even all the way through to biblical references, but trade, history, all these references, and just like the love heart is this symbol of something that we're all very familiar with, I was just using the dice as a symbol. So I'd painted these thinking that what they would look like when they were rolled if they were still wet. So this was, you know, there's kind of minimalist sculpture meets Arte Povera, sort of with some abstract expressionist ambitions there. And as I was saying, you know, there's a lot of weight behind the dice. And I just thought, well, if there's so much weight, like, you know, with what these really mean, like gambling and trading and Roman soldiers throwing dice to see who gets Jesus' shroud when he comes off the cross. I thought, what if you made them really big, that they could maybe take that weight physically. So these are the bad luck die. And they're 8 foot by 8 foot by 8 foot. And I'd made them, and you know, they were basically just bigger remakes of the bad luck dice. And they dominate the space that they're in. You know, you have to move around them. They push you around, and they're very domineering. And I liked it. But so much of the work is about being open and about being given and giving. And I thought, these are really good, but I'm really happy. But they're just, there's something that's not quite me. So I cut the holes out, or the pips, as they're actually called. So I cut the pips out so that you can then see through the dice. They're painted inside and out. So you can see through this face of the dice to the back face of the next face, through to the next front face. And again, it's just this folding things in on themselves that I feel happens a lot in the work. Again, a kind of little bit of deception, but not in a mean way. Because I really had to open these up, so when the viewer comes in, they're still kind of dominant, but there's still a kind of an engagement there, which is really kind of necessary for me in the work. You know, it's yeah, it's just two big sculptures. You know, in this dripping, like the nail polish, it's kind of seductive, like that, or that's what I was kind of looking for, you know. And again, as I say, like this, what are you seeing and what are you not seeing and where are you seeing? To me, just comes through in a lot of the work. And I guess there's a notion, you know, again, like the smaller dice, what did these look like when they, like, what would they look like if they were rolled when they were wet? But of course, they couldn't even make a quarter turn. So again, there's that little bit of trickery, I guess. So yeah, I've got it written down here, like, about what I'm doing and playing with the sense of what's real and what's not, and maybe more so what could be real, what can be real and what can't be. And it's not really done to trick the viewer, or, you know, it's supposed to be an engagement, it's supposed to be a connection. And more often than not, it looks like I'm just really playing a trick on myself. So it's not really an artifice, I don't think. And, you know, in keeping with that theme that I've got going, is I'm going to round off what I'm talking about tonight at the beginning. So I moved to New York 13 years ago. Again, it's absolutely true. I moved there in 1998. And somehow that's brought me here tonight with you guys. And this was a piece of work that I made that's called Air Traffic Control. And I didn't really have anything to make. But I realized, living in Brooklyn, I'm under a flight path to JFK and to LaGuardia. And I'd always thought, you know, I'd just moved away from home. I had lived away from home before, but this was like a big leap. This felt like me really, I've gone. I've left. And I thought, when I'd look at these planes every day, like, I'd think about the people on them, and I'd think about where they were going, and I'd think about who they'd left, who they'd just left, and who they'd be missing, who they loved, and what that felt like to sit on a plane and just be going somewhere when you were leaving something or somebody behind. And then I thought about the other people who are on that, going to see someone that they've been missing, and that feeling of when you're going there and you just can't wait to, like, hold that person in your arms. And, you know, there's a lot of romance in the work, I think, not just in this. So I took a chocolate box and a drinking straw and some chewing gum and stuck the straw to the chocolate box that I'd painted black and stood on the roof with my little remote control whilst the planes went over. So the remote control's fake, the aeroplanes are real, but this, more than anything, the sentiment is real. It's totally real. And this is a series that I made when I first moved there. And it's just that little thing about in some way touching someone, touching their life, or just giving a little something. And these people would never know. And who knows, maybe somebody here could have been on one of those planes at some point. And it's just the idea of the connection again that's important to me. And these little moments, and these little fragments of human life that, you know, we can celebrate and we get the privilege to make. So I think, you know, I cry a lot on planes. Just be hopeful you're not sitting beside me. So there you go. I do a lot of collecting, and what am I doing? Am I collecting friends? Am I collecting relationships? I don't really know what I'm trying to do. But, you know, in my work, there's this constant process. Make, remake, redo, rethink, reassess, and edit. So open the newspaper, cut it up, be open to chance, control chance, rearrange it, but compose it, but always let those possibilities come in. Pour the nail polish on the page, move the page around, put it down, pick up the bottle, pick up the next page, and get on the plane. Thanks. So now it's questions. I'm going to ask you all questions, yeah. Does anybody have any questions? Hi.
How many copies of 1984 do you have?
I think at the moment I've got about 600, 650.
So if we give our copies to Terry, could she give them to you?
Absolutely, and they would be received. Really, that sentiment. Absolutely, yeah. I don't mean that in any kind of light-handed way. I love that. It's taking and giving, like I say, you know. Yeah, and thanks for coming out. It's a beautiful evening. You could have been somewhere else. Anybody else?
Don't you feel a small pang of guilt about removing all those copies of this essential, this really powerful, necessary book from the possibility of anybody reading it?
No, they can go to the shop and buy another copy. I really don't. It's never crossed my mind. Sorry. And my notion is I'm really, really trying to be protective of the book, you know, as everything moves on. And a lot of the work, like, as you see, is like about that tactility of the material, of handling it and holding it. And these books, like, they span so many different editions. And, you know, I have copies in French and German, you know, Polish, Czech. I have lots and lots of different copies. But no, I don't. Actually, I guess, to be cynical, it would be better if you have to keep going out and buying them. Then they might end up in a second-hand bookshop one day. And I could have them. Terry?
Can you talk a little bit about Rabo's painting? You said there were two describing the story. So what was your program for that?
So the two he described...